be considered quaint, but to an 18-year-old freshman out of northern Indiana, navigating a subway unsupervised seemed nothing less than an initiation into the ways of the metropolis. I made an effort to blend in, entering the station weekly to catch the train for an internship at the JFK Library. As I trotted down the crowded steps, I would try to mimic the worldly and jaded affect of the commuters around me. But as I returned later in the evening, hustling past the florist and the Dunkin' Donuts, and on up the stairs into the square, my face would still have stood out among the grumpy Bostonians, betraying the fact that I was as exhilarated by the idea of being in a big city as I was by the new marvels of college life. I would emerge into the square, eyes darting around the lively scene. There were the teenage punks, their expressions just a little too bored to be menacing, who loitered with skateboards off the entrance to the station. Always, someone would be passing out flyers, usually for something edgy like a Lyndon LaRouche for President rally or a Chomsky talk down at MIT. Nearby, at Aubon Pan, lingered a mix of postdocs, autodidact geniuses, and drifters. Some of the outdoor tables had chessboards built into them, one permanently occupied by a man with a little sign inviting you to play the chess mister. Looking up overhead, I could note the time on a lighted display over the Cambridge Savings Bank building. I felt that telling the time by reading it off a building, instead of a watch, affirmed that I was now in a bustling place of consequence, as downtown South Bend had perhaps once been. Past out-of-town news, where you could get exotic newspapers like La Repubblica or Le Monde, I would cross the street where, unlike home, cars would actually yield to pedestrians. Across Massachusetts Avenue and through a gate, the loose energy of the square suddenly gave way to the serene precincts of Harvard Yard. The darkening quadrangle bespoke a kind of meaningful silence. Henry Adams would say, if Harvard College gave nothing else, it gave calm. As I trekked across it to my red brick dorm, Holworthy Hall. My room on the fourth floor was itself a wonder. It had hardwood floors and a wall of exposed brick, a style I'd only seen in fashionable restaurants and occasionally on television. There was even a fireplace, bricked up, but still, and a fire escape that, with some imagination and well-meaning disregard for rules, could serve as a balcony. A letter on your pillow had a list of everyone who had ever lived in your room, which in my case included Ulysses Grant Jr., Cornel West, and Horatio Alger. No less impressive were the present occupants living up and down the staircase. They all seemed easygoing and normal enough at first, but soon it began to feel like the Academy of X-Men. Everyone had some concealed special power. Kate, on the second floor, could read books at 4 or 5 times the normal pace. Andrew, on the ground floor, could do a Rubik's Cube from any starting point in about a minute. Steve, my roommate, was like a science fiction telepath. He could dissect social interactions and predict with remarkable accuracy how the relationships among other freshmen we knew would play out with time. Pretty much everyone expertly played musical instruments, sports, or both. I had gone from the top of my high school class to wondering how I would measure up. From out the big green door of our Holworthy Hall entryway, I could look into the faint fog of history that blankets Harvard Yard, knowing which dorms had housed which U.S. presidents, from Adams, Massachusetts Hall, to Kennedy, Weld. Subtle cues everywhere linked history with expectation. A stone lintel over one of the gates read, "Enter to grow in wisdom," and on the other side, "Depart to serve better thy country and thy kind." Though the 17th century Puritans who founded the place wouldn't exactly recognize it these days, the basic message had not changed. You were among a select few admitted to this place for the rare privilege of a fine education, and you had better put it to good use. There were daily reminders that you were expected to be part of history, if not magnificently, then tragically. In Memorial Hall, after filling your belly with scrambled eggs, you emerged into a church-like transept, lit through stained glass and lined with marble panels bearing the memories of Harvard's Civil War dead by name, date, and place, each punctuated by a grave period. The names all seemed characteristically Harvard. The place names seemed apt, too, almost as if those places had originally been named in the foreknowledge that a great many men would one day die there. I sometimes paused to recite a few of them, under my breath, between eating breakfast and going to class. Peter Augustus Porter, 3rd June, 1864, Cold Harbor. Richard Chapman Goodwin, 9th August, 1862, Cedar Mountain. George Whittemore, 17th September, 1862, Antietam. William Oliver Stevens, 4th May, 1863, Chancellorsville. I tried to envision being part of the Civil War generation of Harvard students, or for that matter, the World War I and II soldiers remembered at nearby Memorial Church. What would it be like to wrestle with college education at the same time a nation was at war? In that fall of 2000, it was hard to picture. War seemed unimaginably remote and theoretical, something that happened only to populations of a different time and place. Still less could I imagine that, after graduating, I would ever have occasion to carry a weapon on foreign soil. As soon as I arrived on campus, I started hanging around the Institute of Politics, better known as the IOP, a center for undergraduates that brought speakers and fellows from government, policy, and journalism for the purpose of inspiring young people to pursue public service. At various events, you would munch on cheese or pepperoni pizza with impressive fellows. That fall's slate included Rick Davis, fresh off managing John McCain's first presidential campaign, and Jamil Mawad, the ex-president of Ecuador, who had just been deposed in a coup. More formal events in the forum would host a cabinet member or foreign prime minister, there to give a speech containing some significant policy pivot that would make headlines the next day. At first, the proximity of these figures was one more shot in the arm for an already healthy Ivy League student ego. But the more attention you paid to the leaders who came through, especially the most accomplished ones, the more you sensed that their effectiveness did not come from the playing up of prestige. The IOP's director, the retired Senator David Pryor of Arkansas, embodied this. He specialized in putting you at ease. Slow-talking and plain-spoken, he cultivated the demeanor of a kindly bumpkin. Not very tall and just a little hunched, he would look at you with wide and gentle eyes and greet you in the southern drawl you might expect of a former senator from Arkansas. Listening as you spoke, he would first furrow his eyebrows in concentration. Then they would rise and his face would slowly open as he took in whatever you had to say with interest and pleasure. Interacting with him, you would feel special and disarmed, forgetting that you were face-to-face with the man who had outmaneuvered the segregationist former governor Orville Faubus, mentored a young Bill Clinton, and dominated the politics of his home state for a generation. This was the political education we really needed, the realization that success in politics was not necessarily about impressing people with your pedigree or intellect. Pryor's successor at the IOP, former Agriculture Secretary and Kansas Congressman Dan Glickman, had a similar humble streak, only with a Midwestern flavor. At a function or meeting with students, he would never fail to open by joking that he never could have gotten into Harvard, and I suppose we took that at face value rather than as flattery. In fact, Glickman had a law degree from George Washington University, had chaired the House Intelligence Committee, and was an authority on the modern role of Congress. As a freshman, you might have been lulled into thinking that you really were deserving of such compliments from this cabinet secretary. By junior year, hearing the same sort of thing, you would have matured enough to realize you were the recipient of a kindness, the treatment that is instinctual to a politician who knows that you will be best to work with if you have first been made to feel good about yourself. Politics was in the air freshman year, though in retrospect it seemed like almost a quaint kind of politics, preoccupied with arguments that hadn't changed much since the 1980s. I volunteered for Al Gore's campaign that fall, chauffeuring guests around Boston during the run-up to the presidential debate there. But the sense among many students was that Bush and Gore were barely distinguishable on domestic policy, center-left versus center-right. The biggest campaign-related excitement was the arrival of riot police on the outskirts of the debate site to contend with Green Party protesters who were marching and chanting, "Let Ralph debate." When Bush ultimately prevailed in the Supreme Court and claimed the presidency, it still felt like little would change from the Clinton era. National politics seemed sleepy compared to the scene on campus itself. In April 2001, a student group called the Progressive Student Labor Movement took over the offices of the university's president, demanding a living wage for Harvard janitors and food workers. That spring, a daily diversion on the way to class was to see which national figure, Cornel West or Ted Kennedy one day, John Kerry or Robert Reich another, had turned up in the yard to encourage the protesters. Striding past the protesters and the politicians addressing them, on my way to a pizza and politics session with a journalist like Matt Bai or a governor like Howard Dean, I did not guess that the students poised to have the greatest near-term impact were not the social justice warriors at the protests, nor the more buttoned-up types I would find at the Institute of Politics, but a few mostly apolitical geeks who were quietly at work in Kirkland House, the dorm across the street, cooking up a virtual version of the paper Facebooks that Harvard would distribute on move-in day. We knew, of course, that the new century would herald great technological change. So much ink has been spilled on the flood of tech's arrival that it is hard to say much about it that isn't repetitive. But even now, looking back, the swiftness of it is stupefying. In that fall of 2000, my freshman dorm had a, quote, cordless phone linked to a wired base from which I could dial a 1-800 number to use a long-distance calling card and then reach home in South Bend. 1 year later, I returned to campus with a Sprint flip phone whose monochrome display let you see the number that was calling you, and which remarkably charged the same no matter what area code you were calling. One more year passed, and I had in my pocket a tiny, as was the fashion then, T68i phone by Ericsson with a 101x80 pixel display boasting 256 colors. What most excited me about it, as a tech fan, was that it could connect to a computer with a new technology called Bluetooth and download your address book without you having to key in every name with the numeric keypad. A year after that, I began to see the occasional professional around town with her face glued to a BlackBerry, which could be used to read email. What could possibly be so compelling, I thought, on that little screen? The front end of Harvard's own website, as of September 2000, was about one page long and was all text except the Harvard logo and a rotating campus news photo the size of a postage stamp. To check email, you would open up a Telnet window and use a program called Pine to bring up an interface that resembled an Atari game. By 2002, the Harvard Crimson had occasion to run a story on the remarkable fact that newly arrived freshmen were checking their email almost exclusively by webmail. As part of a side job for the IOP, I was entrusted in the fall of 2002 with an expensive digital camera, which I used to take photographs of visiting speakers, like Serbian Prime Minister Zoran Djindjic and Senator Kennedy. By the following year, as Serbia reeled from Djindjic's assassination, most students had a digital camera of their own. Junior year, I got a camcorder for Christmas and brought it to campus to take video footage of dorm life. By senior year, to the great amusement of friends, I could edit it on my own laptop and burn it to a DVD. YouTube would not exist for another year. Social media wasn't a term of art yet, though we did notice it beginning to emerge around us even before Mark Zuckerberg changed the way all of us relate to the internet and to each other. There was MySpace, and something called Friendster, and a few others that I never got around to signing up for. For a brief period, online social networking seemed like it might be a fad. It was intriguing, but could meet the same fate as the short-lived Cosmo.com, a within-the-hour retail delivery service that was popular on campus during my freshman year, but arrived 15 years too soon. But something did feel different about that February of 2004, when the creation of thefacebook.com ricocheted around campus, and we came to view it as part of Harvard, like the Crimson or the Square. It became indispensable for checking on your friends and exchanging gossip, and began to overtake AOL Instant Messenger and even compete with email. Texting was still sporadic since you generally had to pay by the text. Suddenly, you could look up who was friends with whom, and who was seeing whom. In the privacy of my room, out of what I told myself was curiosity, I could even search which users were men whose profiles said they were interested in men. Still years away from facing the reality of my own sexual orientation, I had no practical use for the information. But I was impressed that some of my classmates had no reservations about putting it online in this way. Only today can I imagine the comedy of traveling back in time to tap my 21-year-old self on the shoulder and explain to him that one day he would use a Facebook-connected app on a phone to be introduced to his future husband. Academically, it didn't take long to decide that I should major in Harvard's program in history and literature. Plenty of subjects had been interesting in school, but it was literature that had captured not just my mind, but also my emotions. I had wanted to explore it deeply ever since reading Robert Frost's The Road Not Taken in Mr. Wiley's sixth grade English class at Stanley Clark School. At 12 years old, it felt like a sudden enlightenment when we learned that this poem wasn't just about two roads in a forest, but about the choices we make in life. Once I'd figured out what a metaphor was, I saw them on every page of text. I wanted to read every great author, maybe even become a novelist. And doing history and literature together meant that I could also study pretty much anything that had a past: ideas, politics, foreign countries, and global affairs. I decided to focus on American studies, bolstered by my good fortune of landing a freshman seminar with Zach Van Berkovich. As English professors go, he was famous. My father made it clear to me that studying with him was a big deal. Berkovich had deeply impacted American studies by pointing out all the ways in which modern America owed its culture to the influence of the early Puritans. Until then, I had considered the Puritan years to be the most boring period in all of American history, full of dour and interminable sermons by the likes of Cotton Mather. But to Berkovich, the Puritans were the key to American identity. His seminal book, The American Jeremiad, described a distinctly American form of rhetoric that goes back to Puritan sermons and persists in our culture even now, a way of castigating society for failing to live up to its sacred covenant while reinforcing the sense of promise in what we could become. The threads of influence are easy to find if you know what to look for. Ronald Reagan and John F. Kennedy each used the same phrase, "city upon a hill," to describe America's destiny among nations. In doing so, they used imagery that traces back to John Winthrop and the sermon he gave using that same phrase almost 400 years ago, aboard the ship that would bring him and his followers to America. Berkovich explained how Winthrop's image of America as a beacon of virtue would become the basis for an American exceptionalism that helps define our country to this day. Berkovich was an unlikely character for Harvard, a son of Canadian Jewish radicals. They had named him after the anarchist martyrs Sacco and Vanzetti, who began his career as a dairy farmer on a kibbutz in Israel. He described returning to Canada and becoming a manager at a grocery store, where his bosses funded him to attend night school out of embarrassment that someone in management lacked a degree. Though a giant in his field, in person he was unassuming, a little stooped, with big eyes and a permanent, mischievous smile. He was semi-retired by the time I got into his seminar, teaching just for the fun of it. He took a liking to me and hired me as a research assistant on his massive project of editing the Cambridge History of American Literature. I was happy to have the work, the pocket money, and the time around such an eminent scholar, though by now I was beginning to realize for certain that I would not become an English professor like him or my parents. Under his influence, I would write my thesis about another Puritan sermon, less famous than Winthrop's, a paean to the early missionaries' errand into the wilderness. A generation after Winthrop, in 1670, Samuel Danforth gave a classic Jeremiad excoriating his followers and society for forgetting their purpose in coming to the New World. Now, let us sadly consider whether our ancient and primitive affections to the Lord Jesus, his glorious gospel, his pure and spiritual worship, and the order of his house remain, abide, and continue, firm, constant, entire, and inviolate. Our Savior's reiteration of this question, "What went ye out into the wilderness to see?" is no idle repetition, but a sad conviction of our dullness and backwardness to this great duty, and a clear demonstration of the weight and necessity thereof. If Winthrop saw America becoming a blessed example of godly living to which all others might turn, Danforth spoke of America's civilizing mission, to go out into wild and savage lands, over the vast ocean into this waste and howling wilderness, he said, and make them more like the image of heaven on earth. In my senior thesis, I drew a line from this thinking to America's Cold War insistence on invading Vietnam to save it from godless communism, leading to a different and doomed errand into the jungle. I compared the American government's narrative about Vietnam with the views of outside commentators, like the British novelist Graham Greene, whose novel, The Quiet American, bore out his skepticism of America's purposes. In Greene's novel, based partly on real events, an idealistic young American intelligence operative winds up contributing to a terrorist attack in Vietnam, all with the best of intentions. Innocence, Greene observes in the novel, is like a dumb leper that has lost his bell, wandering the world, meaning no harm. Greene's world-weary English Catholic outlook could not have been more different from the Puritan-inflected American understanding of its Cold War mission. Though my focus was America, I also took courses in Arabic. In high school, I had read the Sudanese novelist Tayyib Saleh's masterpiece, Season of Migration to the North, which tells of an African graduate student's romantic conquest of several young British women in a sort of inverted version of the plot of Heart of Darkness. Just from the linguistic rhythm and the poetic richness of the translated language, I could sense how beautiful the Arabic prose must have been, and I wanted to learn the original. Plus, a bit vaguely, I figured that knowing Arabic would be useful for a future career in public service or journalism. It was hard, much harder than the French and Spanish I had studied in high school, or even the Maltese, also a Semitic language, that I had picked up from my father. But it was also a highly rewarding language to learn. At first, the English-speaking learner struggles to grab hold of something, since there are almost no similarities between our words and theirs. But after a year or two of learning, the structure of the language begins to unfold and reveal itself. And unlike almost any other language, you can derive most words you don't know by using the words you do know. After a while, it's all prefixes, suffixes, and rearrangement of a few vowels to make whole families of words according to strict patterns. It all works by analogy. You can take the same changes you make to the word for cooking to get the word for kitchen, and do it to the word for writing to get the word for office. When I showed up in late 2000, not many people were studying Arabic. I don't think there were more than a dozen of us in that first-year class my freshman fall. Most were Arab or Jewish students interested in getting in touch with personal roots. We knew the Middle East was important, but we had no idea that 1 year later, the entire trajectory of America's relationship with the Muslim world would shift. When the planes hit, I was face down on the bottom bunk, oblivious to the sunbeams angling in through the old window panes of my sophomore quarters in Leverett House. It was my dorm mate, Uzzah, rarely one to wake before I did, who knocked on the door, walked in, and said, "Hey, Peter, you might want to see this." Soon there were four or five of us, gathered on the futon in the next room, watching the Today Show coverage as the idea that we had lived to see the end of history collapsed with the two towers. That Tuesday happened to be registration day. At midday, not knowing what else to do, I walked to Harvard Yard to sign up for classes. Everyone seemed to be in a daze, and wide-eyed students everywhere, disproportionately from New York and Washington, were on their cell phones, trying to call home, mostly without success. Standing at an interfaith prayer service hastily organized in Harvard Yard, I looked up and saw a lone fighter jet banking in the crisp and cloudless blue sky overhead, as if to advise all of us below that war was no longer going to be distant or theoretical for us. After trying all day to call home, I finally got through in the evening and reassured my parents that I was all right. It now feels like an odd assurance to have had to make, since the attack happened hundreds of miles away. But that day it seemed as if we all had to check on each other for injury, as if anyone we cared about might have been harmed that morning just by being in the same world where this had happened. A few days earlier, I had turned up at Logan Airport with my bags packed for school. This morning, some men had stepped on that same curb, walked through that same concourse, boarded a half-empty airplane, and murdered their way into a new chapter of world affairs. It was immediately clear that the project of my generation had just been reassigned in some way. The infinite peace of post-Cold War promise was in fact a mirage, and we would be dealing with matters we thought our grandparents' generation had settled, having to do with war, terror, and freedom. It was hard not to think of that wall in Memorial Hall, and wonder how many of my classmates would wind up among a new generation of war dead. There was a few days' ellipsis in which politics seemed remote. As people were still being pulled out of the rubble, and grief provoked us to say things like, "We will never be the same," America felt more decent in mourning. Articles were written about the death of irony, and for a moment, it felt as if the vengeful return of history would give us all the seriousness of historians, grappling with the complex forces that had brought us to this point. We seemed, for those few days, not just wounded, but morally aware. Within days, President Bush was visiting a mosque, eloquently distinguishing between Islamist terrorism and Islamic people. "Islam is peace," he said, in a speech largely forgotten today. Women who cover their heads in this country must feel comfortable going outside their homes. Just weeks earlier, the nation had been obsessed with shark attacks and a philandering congressman. Now we seemed to have matured overnight. Perhaps inevitably, that sense didn't last for long. We might have lost our innocence and learned something about the world, but we did not suddenly become wise. Americans were facing the first case in a generation in which a chain of events that started overseas shook and changed all of our lives. It's impossible to expect that we would respond by leaping to a new moral plane, or that we would immediately grasp the complexity of the global forces that had just come to harm us. Nor were we remotely prepared for the idea of modern asymmetric warfare. Scanning AOL Instant Messenger away messages, which in retrospect represented an early 2000s forecast of what Twitter would be like, I saw a message from one friend that summed up how it looked to many. "Doesn't Afghanistan know we have bombs?" It took a while to catch on to the idea that this was an attack on the United States, not by the country of Afghanistan, but by Al-Qaeda, protected by the Taliban, which governed most Afghans, but was not exactly an administration. We had been attacked by a transnational network hosted by a rogue regime presiding over a failed state. The responses were largely knee-jerk. A Patriot Act that undercut the freedoms that define America, and several quick steps down the slippery slope to torture. So slow were we to realize how fundamentally different this was than wars we had studied in school or seen in movies, that by October we were bargaining against our own values, moving steadily and surely into the jaws of a trap that Al-Qaeda had laid for us. It was years before I would get formal training in counterterrorism as a military officer, but it seemed clear even then as a history student that the new national approach on terrorism was likely to be self-defeating. The top priority of the terrorist, even more important than killing you, is to make himself your top priority. This is why protecting ourselves from terrorist violence is not enough to defeat terrorism, especially if we try to achieve safety in ways that elevate the importance of terrorists and wind up publicizing their causes. We all want to avoid being harmed, but if the cost of doing so is making the terrorist the thing you care about most, to the exclusion of the other things that matter in your society, then you have handed him exactly the kind of victory that makes terrorism such a frequent and successful tactic. A spectacle of murder and destruction, though it killed far fewer people than ordinary gun violence, car accidents, or even cigarettes, had the power to loosen our commitment to freedom at home and shatter our restraints on involvement abroad. It was clear enough why America had to do something to Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. But it was not clear what American values the administration was willing to compromise in the context of what it was starting to call the global war on terror. Would our civil liberties be diminished in the name of protecting us? Would the long-time certainty that America does not torture people hold? Would America commit to supporting freedom and democracy in deed as well as word? Or would we back any dictator who claimed to side with us in the new global war, ignoring what was happening in his own country? The answers started to pour in, mostly discouraging. Soon, our government was sending prisoners to third-party countries for torture. It was supporting a grotesque dictatorship in Uzbekistan abroad and checking on people's library usage at home, all in the name of fighting terrorism. At the same time, little was said about personal sacrifice at home for the purpose of winning a national conflict. Kids in World War II saved tinfoil from gum wrappers for the war effort. Women reused nylon stockings as many times as possible, and everyone then knew why they were being asked to pay much higher taxes. This time around, it seemed that the war effort was wholly outsourced to those few Americans who served in uniform. America tripped over itself to salute them, without seeming to consider the possibility that civilians, too, could accept some risk or pay some contribution into the cause of freedom. I thought again of the names on that Civil War memorial wall, as it became clear that this time, the task of dealing with this conflict would be assigned to a class of professional soldiers, not shared by all of our society on an all-hands-on-deck basis. We might have had, in those years, a more serious conversation about what each of us owes to the country in a time of conflict. We might have been asked to weigh what risks we are willing to tolerate, personally, in order to remain certain that this is a free country. But after those first few seemingly enlightened days, the country's leadership showed little interest in helping us confront the choices we would have to make between safety and freedom. Truly grasping and defeating the logic of suicide terrorism was too much for our Congress or administration, which lapsed instead into simplistic rhetoric. Emblematic of this was the sudden adoption by administration spokespeople and Fox News anchors of the bizarre term homicide bomber instead of suicide bomber. It may have scratched an emotional itch, but the terminology was doubly useless, both belaboring the obvious fact that bombers are generally homicidal and obscuring the tactically useful distinction between those murderers who are prepared to kill themselves in the process and those who are not. Soon the president was telling us that either you are with us or you are with the terrorists, a dictum impossible for America to uphold or enforce in the case of Pakistan and many other states playing the three-dimensional chess game of geopolitics in the Islamic world. Next, it was an axis of evil, and so on. For the home front, the message was that we would be kept safe through the deployment of force and the acceptance of some encroachments on our freedom and privacy. And also, for some reason, we would need to invade Iraq. As a student, I couldn't see for myself what all this was wreaking upon our politics until I went home for the summer of 2002 and volunteered on the campaign of Jill Long Thompson, who was running as a Democrat for the U.S. House seat in South Bend. The typical rule is that the president's party fares badly in a midterm election, but there was no indication that that would happen this year. Democrats, unsure of themselves, were afraid to sound like an opposition at all, and many carefully avoided opposing the Iraq war for fear of looking unpatriotic. Some, particularly Hillary Clinton, would come to regret this posturing. Instead, they tried to change the subject, emphasizing Social Security and Medicare, even though global security was the dominant issue of our moment, even in Indiana. One hot day that summer, I was sent to help with the Fulton County Democratic Party's entry in a rural small-town parade. As we prepared our little float with campaign signs and balloons, I did a double take at the parade entry next to us, belonging to Country Kids Daycare. A group of cute, rambunctious 10-year-olds in red t-shirts proudly showed me their float, which consisted of a large, uneven pair of 4-foot-high model skyscrapers made out of foam core. Around the top of the gray rectangular objects, a loose wrap of fishnet and mesh suggested dark smoke, while flames made of orange construction paper shot out the side of one of the objects, surrounded by cotton balls representing more billowing smoke. A big American flag shared the flatbed that carried this strange scene, and a sign on the back read, "United We Stand." This was a rural Indiana kids' daycare craft project circa July 2002. They had made a little 9/11. Before the end of the decade, I would see Iraq for myself, visiting Baghdad as a civilian economic advisor. But back then, all I knew was what I learned in class and read in the paper. I saw our president declare that Saddam Hussein must disarm his chemical and biological weapons, and vow, if he won't do so voluntarily, we will disarm him. The tough talk was rousing, but it made no strategic sense. Saddam was a notoriously sinister dictator whose top priority, as with all dictators, was his own survival. It followed that he viewed his arsenal of chemical and biological weapons, as most of us believed he had, as an insurance policy to keep him in power. He would only part with them voluntarily if it would benefit his personal security, an unlikely course for someone who did not trust America. But actually using them would almost certainly lead to his destruction, so he had every reason to sit on his weapons if he had them. The only scenario where he might use them would be if he had nothing to lose by doing so. And now, by invading, we were poised to create that very situation. Logically, this meant that an invasion would be very costly and bloody for American troops. Invited to represent the college Democrats at a rally outside the Science Center at Harvard, I spoke of the difference between necessary wars, like those memorialized in the church nearby, and unnecessary wars that could take young lives for no purpose at all. It turns out that most of us, for and against the war, were wrong about the weapons. He didn't have any, and so they were not there to be used against American troops. Iraq fell quickly, and for a moment it seemed that the invasion was a vindication of American intervention abroad. Protesters like me looked foolish. Sure, the pretext for war was actually false, but who would quibble over that, as a brutal dictatorship was being turned into a model democracy at relatively little cost to America? Then the suicide bombings began. We were not, as the administration had promised, greeted as liberators. A well-functioning democracy did not emerge, and the ensuing chaos made it clear that the administration had not planned for the aftermath of the invasion as Iraqi cities became a kill zone for our troops. We who were against the invasion had been wrong about the weapons, but right about the war. The administration had been wrong about both. As all this unraveled, I was spending my senior year mostly absorbed in a different war, Vietnam, the focus of my thesis on the influence of Puritan thought. In an unused seminar room that a few of us had taken over, I sat surrounded by Dunkin' Donuts coffee cups and books, immersed in the recent past, while its parallels with the present became impossible to ignore. I studied the way America's government in the 1970s told its people an increasingly improbable story of mission and moral clarity, trying to defy a reality on the ground that could no longer be denied amid a rising American body count. I remember very little about senior week or graduation, other than that it rained, and that we had a sense of graduating into a darkening world, where we would need to make ourselves useful. We had arrived on campus during the final months of the Clinton presidency, on the heels of the longest peacetime economic expansion in U.S. history. Now we were wartime graduates. It felt like a kind of memorial service for our vanishing college life as we filed in our black gowns into the expanse of the open quadrangle known as Tercentenary Theater and sat facing Memorial Church while the massive structure of Widener Library towered behind us under the warm rain clouds. I listened vaguely as the UN Secretary General, Kofi Annan, gave a speech about three simultaneous global crises of security, solidarity, and cultural division. Meanwhile, at William and Mary's commencement address, John Stewart treated the graduates to a cheeky but rueful commentary on the real world on behalf of the generation in charge. I don't really know how to put this, so I'll be blunt. We broke it. But here's the good news. You fix this thing, you're the next greatest generation, people. Chapter 3. Analytics. The education that began at Harvard continued in one form or another for the next 10 years. First came Campaigns 101, for which my classroom was a cubicle in a windowless office in downtown Phoenix, where I did research and press work for the Kerry Edwards presidential run of 2004. After that defeat, I followed my boss, Doug Wilson, back to Washington, where he worked for the former defense secretary, William Cohen. The winter and spring amounted to Washington 101, an education in the mechanics of our capital, which I navigated as a sort of gopher for Doug, helping him to organize a conference of American and Muslim leaders. This included an early lesson in the whims of political fortune after we invited the three Republicans then deemed most likely to become president, George Allen, Lindsey Graham, and Mark Sanford. The summer of 2005 saw me back in an actual classroom, this time in Tunis, where a highly affordable language program gave me the chance to improve my Arabic. Formal education continued that fall. A Rhodes Scholarship took me to Oxford for 2 years in large halls and small professors' rooms in the ancient colleges, learning philosophy, politics, and economics. Back to the U.S. in 2007, I landed a job in Chicago at McKinsey & Company, and my classroom was everywhere, a conference room, a serene corporate office, the break room of a retail store, a safe house in Iraq, or an airplane seat, any place that could accommodate me and my laptop. The capstone on my decade of education was in 2010, when I left McKinsey for a tough but priceless year-long political crash course in which I challenged the state treasurer of Indiana and was overwhelmingly defeated in my first experience on the ballot. Geographically, the arc of these years was a sort of looped boomerang, a first departure from home that took me east, then farther west, then back east, then across the Atlantic, and then at last closer to home, to Chicago, less than 100 miles from South Bend, and finally all the way back to the neighborhood where I grew up. In retrospect, it was a homeward spiral all along. The more my worldly education grew with lessons from abroad, the clearer it became that this long and winding road was leading me back home to find belonging by making myself useful there. Now it's obvious, but in the midst of that education, it felt like just one step at a time. A Tunisian souk, an Oxford exam room, and a Great Lakes office park all had something to teach me, and each place nudged me closer to home. Education can come by drudgery or by adventure, and I had my share of both. Sometimes they're interwoven. In Washington, days spent mostly arranging other people's airline tickets were occasionally punctuated by the chance to tag along and meet some foreign ambassador as part of the conference preparations, adventure enough for a 22-year-old interested in policy. In Tunis, where air conditioning was as rare as a summer day below 100 degrees, mornings in the sweaty classroom gave way to afternoons walking through hookah smoke and perfume in the markets of the old city and trying in vain to get Tunisian acquaintances to reveal over coffee how they felt about living under a dictatorship. A few years later, the Arab Spring would tell us things that the friendly yet circumspect young Tunisians would not discuss openly with foreign students, no matter how many prying and dangerous questions we naively asked. At Oxford, my chosen program was Unforgiving, the watchword of the famous PPE, Philosophy, Politics, and Economics, program was rigor. Any sloppy argument or imprecise claim would get picked apart politely by a skeptical professor or fellow student. It was the ideal prescription for someone like me, reared on a humanities curriculum in which a stirring phrase carried as much weight as a precise argument. The missing piece in my formal education had been the analytical side of things, which to my Oxford faculty was the element that mattered most. I was forced to learn the British tradition of analytical philosophy, which breaks down the meaning of the words we throw around casually, yet with conviction, in debates about ethics and politics, sometimes without knowing what we're talking about. Under the gaze of the Oxford dons, every question was handled with the utmost precision to get to the bottom of what was really intended by a term or an idea in the course of an argument. For example, in a philosophical debate over the nature of free will, we were required to confront just how difficult it is to define what free will even means. We considered one definition, that a freely chosen act is one taken by someone who could have done otherwise. It felt intuitively like a good way of describing free will. If I did something and could have done something else, then clearly I made this choice freely. But then, another philosopher pointed out, what if you chose to stay in a room all day because you wanted to, but, without your knowing it, the door was locked from the outside? It turns out you could not have done otherwise, but we also would believe this choice was a free one. So, clearly, a more precise definition had to be found, and the refinements and arguments would go from here. I'm not sure I ever got to the bottom of free will, but these kinds of analyses and arguments cultivated a healthy sense of clarity. After years of painting with broad verbal brushes the kind of beautiful images that earn good grades in certain American college literature courses, I now had to make sure that every sentence and idea was precise, clearly defined, and airtight in order to survive the skepticism of a British critic. In the process, I learned more rigorous ways to explain the moral intuitions I already had about politics and society. Sitting in one of Oxford's ancient libraries, I learned the theories of John Rawls, who, ironically, taught at Harvard. Rawls became famous for creating a new definition of justice, which boils down to this: a society is fair if it looks like something we would design before knowing how we would come into the world. He imagined a fictional, original position, the position we would be in if we were told we were about to be born, but were not told about the circumstances we would be born into, how tall or short we would be, or of what race or nationality, or what resources or personal qualities we would have. This vision of justice is often compared to being asked how you would want a cake to be divided if you did not know which piece would be yours. Equally, of course. Like most good philosophy in the analytical tradition, it gave precise expression to something we already understand intuitively. For example, it gives us one way to explain why we know that racial equality is a feature of a just society. Even a prejudiced group of people would probably all insist on a racially equal society if they were asked to design in advance a world into which they would soon be born without knowing which race life's lottery would assign them at birth. It was a compelling way of thinking about fairness, and not hard to connect to debates about racial and income inequality in our politics back home. And because nothing there was endorsed as correct, but only as worth studying and picking apart, I was then led to Robert Nozick's impressive conservative critique of Rawls, followed by Gerald Cohen's equally impressive socialist critique of Nozick. In ethics, I studied the debates between Kantians, who believe that your motivation is the most important thing in deciding whether you are doing good, and utilitarians, who look only to the outcome of your deeds, not your intent. Years later, in office, I would think of these debates often, knowing that government often requires you to think as a utilitarian, to try to bring about the greatest good for the greatest number, even if your personal philosophy is more Kantian, Christian, or otherwise grounded in something besides the cold math of utilitarian ethics. Meanwhile, studying international relations as part of the politics leg of the PPE program, I learned to trace in detail what happened when a few colonial powers promised, to more than one group of people, the same small patches of Middle Eastern land. And I learned to debate the remarkable finding by political scientists that truly democratic countries almost never go to war with one another. Most new and useful of all, perhaps, was a rigorous training in economics. I had taken an economics course in college, but had known nothing like the intensity of the tutorials at Pembroke College. These one-on-one or two-on-one sessions with faculty were the backbone of instruction at Oxford. In the case of my economics course, they felt less like the friendly and personalized instruction conjured up by the word tutorial, and more like a weekly oral exam on whatever I had managed to teach myself in the preceding 6 days. But the system worked. Racing to catch up to my second-year peers, I mastered the basics of supply and demand, utility, preferences, auction theory, and market equilibrium. I learned to admire the theoretical elegance of the free market under perfect conditions. Then I began to learn about all the situations in which those perfect conditions break down, and all of the ways markets get skewed in the real world. One calculus equation at a time, I came to understand in thorough mathematical detail why supply and demand cannot be expected to deliver fair prices or efficient outcomes in many situations. Indeed, even the most orthodox economic theories showed that market failures were all but guaranteed to occur in situations like healthcare and education delivery, where a seller has power over a buyer, or a buyer is seeking a service that can't easily be assigned a dollar value, or the seller and the buyer have different levels of information about the product. The 2 years passed quickly, rushing toward the handful of days in June of 2007 when, in keeping with the Oxford tradition, I donned a white bow tie, suit, and gown to walk to the giant hall they call the examination schools. There, hundreds of students at a time would sit for each of the 8 3-hour exams that would account for the entirety of our grades. Exiting the last exam, I received a pie in the face from a group of jubilant friends, also per tradition, and spent the next few days waiting for the results. When they were finally posted, on a big sheet of paper with everyone's names on them outside the exam schools, I checked several times to make sure I wasn't misreading. I had finished with a first, the highest grade in their remarkably simple and very British system of first, second upper, second lower, and third class degrees. To an English undergraduate, this single grade becomes a mark you carry for the rest of your life, shaping career opportunities for decades. Knowing I would head back to America meant that there was less at stake for me in the grade, but I took pride in it, even while sensing that the time had come to learn what wasn't on the page and get an education in the real world, if there was such a thing, which is why I went to McKinsey. Analyzing the finer points of a profound question on the nature of freedom is one thing. Analyzing a client's financial future and advising them on what to do about it is another. This is the specialty of McKinsey & Company, the dominant name in the field of management consulting. Since its product is, above all, the intellect of its employees, the firm, better known in consulting circles as The Firm with a capital F, prides itself on hiring not just top business school graduates, but anyone it considers very bright and teachable, such as Rhodes Scholars. To some, McKinsey is the pinnacle of smart and useful analysis in the business world. To others, it is the primary symbol of a trend that sees more and more graduates from prestigious programs go into the private sector when they could be committing themselves to public service, research, or some other worthy pursuit. When I decided to attend an informational session about McKinsey for graduate students, I felt ambivalent but more sympathetic to the latter camp. My education to date, and my hopes of making an impact in the world, pointed to public service, inquiry, and the arts, not business. But I also knew that I would have to understand business if I wanted to make myself useful in practice. Despite all my education, I felt ignorant about how the private sector really worked. I would leave Oxford with a degree in economics, but knew little firsthand about the functions, from logistics to finance, that made the private sector operate. And the firm known best for its expertise on how the private sector works was actually willing to give me an interview for a post-MBA job, taking a chance on the idea that if I was prepared to learn, they could teach me all the things about business I didn't know. Also, crucially, they had a Chicago office. It was not the most glamorous office in the firm. That title probably belonged in London, Dubai, New York, or Silicon Valley. But it was known for the diversity of industries it served, which would make it a good training ground. More importantly, it was a way for me to come back to the Midwest, a region whose role in shaping me had become more obvious the further away I'd moved. When I finally saw the Chicago office for myself on the day of my final round interview, I noticed not just the modern wood paneling, large abstract paintings, and big windows that signified an elegant corporate office space. I also saw, out the windows on the high floor of the Chase Tower where my interviewer received me, a view of Lake Michigan's shoreline that you could trace, past Hyde Park and the South Side and the Skyway Bridge, all the way to the smokestacks marking the state line and the beginning of northern Indiana. Let me ask you, for a moment, to imagine a list of the most interesting subjects in the world, ranked from 1 to infinity. The list is different for each of us, but some topics are fairly high on the list for almost everyone. Topics such as television, religion, warfare, food, sports, space travel, the presidency, and sex. Now, ask yourself where on that list you would put the subject on which I became an expert during the winter of 2010. North American grocery pricing. Not in your top 1,000? Me neither, at the time I was offered to join a team working on a client study on the subject. For an associate, life at McKinsey mostly consists of month-long stints on a team of 3 or 4 people working on an engagement or study, solving a problem for a client. I was there because I had admired the partner in charge of the team since meeting him in the recruiting process. Jeff Helbling was low-key and clean-cut, with a sort of smart and unflappable discipline that melded the styles of his alma maters, West Point and Harvard Business School. A wise McKinsey alum had once told me that there were 4 things to think about when chasing assignments at the firm: geography, industry, function, and people. Of these, she counseled, the most important is people. So when the chance came to work with Jeff, I jumped, even though I was uncertain how much professional fulfillment came from the prospect of commuting to Toronto every week to help a client in the grocery business figure out how to update its prices. Soon I was spending my weekdays in a small, glass-walled conference room with 3 colleagues in a suburban office park, building models to compute how much it would cost to cut prices on various combinations of tens of thousands of items across hundreds of stores in every part of the country. The more I worked on the problem, the more complicated it seemed to become. Eventually, the volume of data went beyond the capabilities of Microsoft Excel, and I began using a program called Microsoft Access. Access is designed to hold databases, but I was using it to do math, stretching its functionality to make it work partly like a computational spreadsheet on top of the data management program it was intended to be. As the data set grew to millions of lines, it started freezing my laptop computer. To make me more productive, the firm mailed a more powerful desktop computer to our team room. I hooked it up and spent the better part of many 14-hour days calculating at the machine, which my colleagues nicknamed Bertha. Against all my expectations, it was fascinating. I wasn't just learning about the retail business or about computer programs. I was also learning about the nature of data. By manipulating millions of data points, I could weave stories about possible futures and gather insights on which ideas were good or bad. I could simulate millions of shoppers going up and down the aisles of thousands of stores, and in my mind, I pictured their habits shifting as a well-placed price cut subtly changed their perceptions of our client as a better place to shop. Even more fulfilling, I became a useful part of a team that I liked. My manager, a young English woman named Hannah Brooks, with a varsity-level cricket career at Oxford under her belt, took good care of our team, checking on how we were doing and trying to protect our weekends from unnecessary encroachments of work. And I wanted to do a good job for her. Jeff came in every week or so to check on progress, and I felt motivated by the task of presenting him and Hannah with interesting results that he could share with the senior leadership of the client. The problem grew ever more complex as we were asked to analyze the data more and more deeply. As the deadline for implementing the price cuts loomed, pressure grew, and so did the hours. Soon we were working 60, 70, 80 hours a week. At one point, a glitch in a computer pricing tool threatened to give every item the wrong UPC code by 1 digit, meaning the system could give dog food the price for olive oil or price a snow shovel as a box of cereal. Everyone involved in the project had to do nothing else for days as we raced to manually correct the problem before the deadline for a round of price changes. One night I stopped work at 4 in the morning, only to toss and turn in my hotel bed, dreaming in spreadsheets. Friends became Excel formulas. Fears were expressed as charts in PowerPoint. Occasionally I had worked that hard on a campaign or on my studies, but it felt strange to put in those kinds of hours, not for a cause, but for a client. I wanted to do a good job for my team, my firm, and my client, but this wasn't life-or-death stuff. And so it may have been inevitable that one afternoon, as I set Bertha to sleep mode to go out to the hallway for a cup of coffee, I realized with overwhelming clarity the reason this could not be a career for very long. I didn't care. For purpose-driven people, this is the conundrum of client service work. To perform at your best, you must learn how to care about something because you were hired to do so. For some, this is not a problem at all. A great lawyer or consultant can identify so closely with the client, or so strongly desire to be good at the job, or be so well compensated, that her purposes and interests, and those of the client, become one. But for others, work can only be meaningful if its fundamental purpose is in things that would matter even if no one would pay you to care about them. No matter how much I liked my clients and my colleagues, delivering for them could not furnish that deep level of purpose that I craved. Once I understood this, I knew it was a matter of time before I had to find another career. I did find ways within the firm to work more on issues that I considered intrinsically important, like energy efficiency research to help mitigate greenhouse gas emissions in the U.S., and war zone economic development work to help grow private sector employment in Iraq and Afghanistan. But every few months, the project and client changed through the natural rhythm of the consulting business, and then it was time to study and care about something and someone new. The churn, which at first had been stimulating, now made me feel unmoored. Not that I had ever truly expected management consulting to become my life's calling. I was in it for the education, and McKinsey had delivered on its promise as a place to learn about industry, about project management, and about myself. Now it was time to seek work that linked whatever skills I had gained to the things that mattered most. Meanwhile, even before resolving what would come after life at the firm, I began looking for ways to use personal time for causes I cared about, such as volunteering on campaigns. I also began researching military service, especially the possibility of being a reserve officer, which meant I could serve without necessarily making it a career. Unexpectedly, it was a campaign trip to Iowa that shifted my attitude on military service from curiosity to reality. Section 3. Campaigning. He must be as aloof and incorruptible as the artist, yet sometimes as near the earth as the politician. John Maynard Keynes. Chapter 4. The Volunteers. "You boys are not dressed to be out in this cold," was how Farmer Doughton introduced himself as he stepped out of his truck and looked the three of us over. It was nearing midnight, and he did not appear to be in a very good mood, but we were as glad to see him as if he had been a long-lost friend. We had tried everything to get our little rental car out of the snow, pushing, pulling, rocking, revving. A clipboard from the back seat was used as a shovel, pick, and ramp, to no effect, until we finally gave up and decided to trudge toward the only light we could see, a farmhouse maybe a half mile away. So much for the shortcut. The homeowner, an elderly lady in a nightgown, did not meet us with a smile and did not invite us in. Not that we were complaining. We felt pretty lucky that she hadn't greeted us with a shotgun. 3 20-something men ringing her doorbell in the middle of the freezing January night. After we explained ourselves, she went to fetch a cordless phone and returned to the door, eyeing us as she reported to her son. "There's 3 fellows here say they got their car stuck in the snow." She listened for a minute, then looked at us and said, "He wants to know who you are." I explained that we were campaign volunteers, not from around here, just trying to take a shortcut, and couldn't get our car unstuck. She studied us silently and then spoke back into the phone with her revised assessment. "It's 3 campaign fellas say they're stuck in the snow." She listened for a moment and hung up. He was on his way. We could wait outside. So we were apprehensive but happy to see Farmer Doughton rumble up in his pickup truck and drive us back to the car. He didn't say much, other than that the temperature on the thermometer at his house read exactly 0, and that we really should have had better gear for the cold weather. The Carhartt-type coveralls he was wearing seemed to do the trick for him. We did have winter coats on, but it wasn't much against the deep freeze. It was the kind of cold where you feel the hairs in your nostrils start to stand on end. The kind of cold where after 10 minutes or so, you don't feel cold at all, but just kind of woozy and weak-headed. After a short drive, we pulled up alongside our ditched car, its hazard lights still blinking, making me think of a half-sunken ship. He produced a towing chain and stood holding it for a moment. We weren't sure what was supposed to happen next. To clarify things, he asked a rhetorical question. "One of you boys going to hook this up to your car, or am I going to get down on my hands and knees and do it for you?" Message received, we quickly got on all fours, racing to try to figure out how to attach it to our vehicle before he changed his mind about helping us at all. I'd like to think that we won Farmer Doughton over, or at least that we parted on fairly good terms once the car was safely back on the main road, which is to say one that was actually paved, somewhere in the general vicinity of the town of Murray, Iowa. We thanked him profusely, even tried to pay him, but he would have none of that. And before leaving, he had warmed up to the point that his grudging curiosity moved him to ask a question. Who were we campaigning for, anyway?